Welcome to the Nation of Writers podcast, presented in conjunction with our exhibit American Voices, which you can explore in person or online at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we discuss the life and legacy of Nguyen Quy Duc. Born in Da Lat, Vietnam in 1958, Duc arrived in the United States at 17 years old as a refugee of the Vietnam War. He would go on to become a journalist, translator, writer, and radio producer, working for the BBC in London, KALW-FM in San Francisco, and for NPR. And he was the host of Pacific Time, KQED-FM Public Radio's national program on Asian and Asian American life. In addition to his journalistic work, Duc also published a hugely influential family memoir, Where the Ashes Are, The Odyssey of a Vietnamese Family, in 1994. Duc's National Public Radio series on Vietnam won the Citation of Excellence from the Overseas Press Club of America. In 2006, he received the Distinguished Service Award from the Society of Professional Journalists for his contributions to journalism. For this episode, we are joined by two writers who knew Duc personally and who co-founded the Diasporic Vietnamese Artists Network, DVAN. Isabelle Thuy Pelo is a writer, professor, and executive director of DVAN. Viet Thanh Nguyen is a writer and professor and Pulitzer Prize winner. Isabelle and Viet are interviewed by Nate King, content and exhibits manager at the American Writers Museum. This conversation originally took place May 20th, 2025, and was recorded over Zoom.
Well, thank you, Isabelle and Viet, for joining me today on this episode of Nation of Writers. I'm looking forward to talking to you about Nguyen Quy Duc and your own work and how he has inspired you. Before we get into that, could you just briefly tell us a little bit about yourselves and how you first encountered Nguyen Quy Duc's work. Isabelle, would you like to get us started?
Oh, yes. My name is Isabelle Thuy Pelo. I'm the executive director of the Diasporic Vietnamese Artist Network. I'm also a professor in Asian American Studies at San Francisco State University. I believe I met Nguyen Quy Duc in 1994 when his book, Where the Ashes Are, were published. And at the time, I was a student at UC Berkeley, and he was the first Vietnamese-American writers that I've met in person. And we were very, and then when we met him, we started to help him to organize events to promote his book because nobody was doing it.
I'm Viet Thanh Nguyen. I'm a writer, and I met Duc around the same time as Isabelle said. I remember I was probably in my early 20s, a student at UC Berkeley, and Duc to me at that time felt like an impossibly old man. But looking back, he was probably in his early 30s, 34 perhaps, much younger than I am now. But not only did he seem like an old man, but he also seemed like an incredibly cultured person as well. I had grown up in this Bay Area city called San Jose, which I thought was quite provincial, fairly or unfairly. I went to school at Berkeley, started to meet people in San Francisco where he lived, and he had his own apartment. He had a convertible. He had a taste for not just the finer things in life, but really more about the beautiful things in life. So he was never the kind of person, for example, who would buy a brand new Mercedes. He bought the old vintage Mercedes that was really cool. So I don't know how his life was what impressed me so much because it was its own work of art. And that's one of the things I'll always remember about Duc was not only that he was a writer, but also that he crafted his own persona. And I think that probably had to do partly with his own experiences as a refugee and having to, leave Vietnam at a young age, older than me, but still a young age in his teens, and having to forge a life for himself as a first as a journalist and then as a writer. So his persona and his early work, including this book that Isabelle mentioned, Where the Ashes Are, his memoir, made a big imprint on me and set up the model for this possibility of what the Vietnamese American literature could be. But also, he was also not just an individual writer and journalist, but he was also always a very social person. He wanted to build movements and collectives. He wanted to have fun, even as he was doing something very serious. So part of what it meant to meet him in the 90s was to become a part of this project that we started together. I don't know whose idea it originally was. I'm pretty sure it was Duc's, which was to form a Vietnamese American arts collective. But I do take credit for the name of the collective, which was Ink and Blood, Mok Va Mau, which is very melodramatic in English and in Vietnamese, but we are very melodramatic people. And our events were probably pretty melodramatic too. They involved a lot of wine and open mics and poetry and were, we were not particularly good organizers in the sense of building an organization, but we were great at throwing parties and art events. And I think we left our imprint. I remember throwing events that drew hundreds of people, for example, at San Francisco State and Stanford University, and smaller, more intimate events at artist studios. And to one of those open mics came this beautiful young woman who became my wife. So all of these things are wrapped up in these memories of Duc and what he represented back in the 90s and onwards.
And then I remember, I mean, one reason I was, as a student, I was, quite shy, but Duc was had English accent, and I have a French accent because my mother is Vietnamese, but I grew up in France. I was born there, so he was very accepting and understanding of that. And I remember Viet, when the name Inkenbrot came, it was his little office in Tenderloin, and it was you, Duc, maybe two, maybe mostly guys from that I remember from the time, and it was a lot of talking, and that came about, and I remember Duc say, "Yes, that sounds great," and I do remember it was you who came up with that name.
Well, thank you for that. There was a lot of men. That is definitely true. A limitation of those times that we, in the subsequent iteration of Ink and Blood, which became the Diasporic Vietnamese Artists Network, a much more boring name in my opinion, but much better probably for 501c3 nonprofit fundraising. Okay, but we've tried to correct some of the limitations and the excesses of that earlier, more romantic, less organized period. Much more gender equity, and equity in terms of many other different identities, including sexual identities as well. But besides there being a lot of men, there's also a lot of smoking, which I didn't partake in, and a lot of drinking, which I still partake in.
It sounds a lot like your time in France when you when the make-believers were all there. I think Vu Tron said something similarly about their time there. So that yeah.
Yes, but the smoking that we have, I mean, it's from a photograph that on the cover of that book, I mean, that magazine. And Duc was supposed to be there, and when quit Duc, and we were sad he couldn't be there because of his illness. But we all smoked because we wanted like to be beda, like rebellious children, although we are old by now, but have this identity. But some of us don't smoke, and actually some of them fake to smoke, but wanted to have the attitude. And living in France. But the one thing I want to say about Duc, like Viet was saying, he was very so he was very we did the work, but it was also a social gathering when he brought people from, students like us and journalists or people from the community and people hanging out, just a lot of hanging out. And after he had Tatiado, a bar in Vietnam, and he continued to do this, right? A lot of food and alcohol, right? Because he's a bar, but bringing music and artists and writers at his bar. And I think, with the Diasporic Vietnamese Artist Network, which really inspired by Duc and Ink and Blood, the continuation of it, but more professionalized way, and make it more diasporic and bigger in some way. But we really try to, or at least for me, to hold on to this idea of the social, of the relational. Yes, professionalism is important, but connection between people around food and drinks and chit chat is that we're able to replicate that in our residencies is really come from that.
If professional is the adjective that we're using to describe the Diasporic Vietnamese Artist Network, I think the adjective for Nguyen Duc throughout his life, but also very evidently during the Ink and Blood period of the 1990s, was probably bohemian. If you go read his obituary in the New York Times from December 2023, written by Seth Meidens, there's a photograph, beautiful photograph of Duc behind his desk at Dadioto, this bar in Hanoi that he opened, as Isabel mentioned, where he's behind a chair. There's pens and pencils and all over the chair. There's a bottle, and he's reclining back with a cigarette in his hand. And it's perfect. I mean, it's the perfect image of Duc that summarizes so many of the things that we've been talking about. It's really hard to hang on to the bohemianism, once you become institutionalized. And I think, I think there was probably always that tension, perhaps, in Duke's life between the bohemian that seemed to be very natural to him and the fact that he was building institutions or becoming a part of institutions. He worked for NPR as a radio journalist and a radio show host. He started Ink and Blood, which became professional, the Diaspora Vietnamese Artist Network. He went to Hanoi to become a businessman, but his business was to run a bar that was sort of the cultural hub for all of the exiles and expats and travelers and so on, all the interesting people from outside of Vietnam coming to Vietnam went there.
Yes. But as I said, like with our residency, we try, that's a place where we try to maintain that. And related to Nguyen Quy Duc, in the last residency we had in January in Vietnam, in Hue, which where he was born, his partner and some of the musicians and friends flew from Hanoi to Hue and had an event with us, with the writers from the residency, because Duke really felt like he wanted to do some Ink and Blood or Divan work through his bar and his network, but he passed. But they flew and offered their time and their talents to celebrate his life. And we had a big event in a really beautiful place that he loved in Hue. And it was, yeah, it was to celebrate his life, and it was wonderful for me to see the continuations, like his spirit was still there with us, and we're still inspired by his work. So he had big influence on us, I believe, with Viet and I, to do what we do now.
Yeah, and I'm struck too by like you said, the musicians and artists came to that celebration. Both of you have generously shared your time with me today. Not everyone gets that, I think. So there's something special about it. I'm curious what you think that is.
I think he was always very generous. So I'll just give you one example. He moved to Hanoi. He opened this bar, Dadioto, which went through a number of variations in different locations. And he also built himself a house up in the mountains, a couple of hours outside of Hanoi. This beautiful house that was featured in one of the magazines that I think was Architectural Digest or something. And it deservedly so. It was sort of bore the stamp of Nguyễn Quy Duc as an artist, as an idiosyncratic person. The house looked nothing like most other homes in Vietnam at the time, and he was always willing to share. So when I came out there, he said, go ahead and stay at the house for a few days. When I got there was somebody else leaving his house who had been staying there, and I know he was always generous with that space, just as he was generous with his time. And whenever I met him, he always seemed like he was overjoyed to see me, even if we hadn't seen each other for a while. I think he probably gave that vibe to everybody that he encountered, or at least the people that I knew in common with him. So I think that spirit of generosity and sharing was always present and made him very beloved. For example, when he would throw these events at Dadioto, and he would invite musicians and artists and writers to come, the space was always as much about all these other people as it was about him. So he was a centerpiece of Dadioto in Hanoi, but really it was all the guests that came, that he invited, that he knew, his network of people, and his willingness to make new friends that turned Dadioto into an interesting space.
Yeah, and I really echo that when I went to the celebration of his life, organized by KQED, and listening to all the speakers, this is really the word also that came to my mind when you asked the question. He was very generous with his time and make everyone feels like they were very special. Yeah, I also received that, and also went to his house, in the jungle up north. And welcome us when we went with a group of riders there, and they offer us drinks and but yes, this is what people speak a lot when they speak about him, about his generosity with this time and being very present with every one of us. Yeah.
Thank you for that. Yeah, I can see why everyone's coming out. Everyone comes out for him, and we've talked a little bit about him as kind of a person. I'm curious if we can get into the writing a little bit, and I guess maybe it is also the timing in which he started publishing is quite important, which you alluded to. Also, there wasn't much going on at the time, especially for Vietnamese writers. So I'm curious if you could just talk about his role in sort of. You've talked about building community, but also just about uplifting writers to the Vietnamese American writing community too. Yeah, just curious if you have any thoughts on that.
I wrote a senior thesis on Vietnamese American literature. So I wrote that thesis in 1992. And at the time, there actually was Vietnamese American literature. There wasn't a lot of it, but there was a handful of books written in English or even sometimes translated into English. And they were, I think, all memoirs of various kinds. And the most notable book up until that point had been Lily Hayslip's When Heaven and Earth Changed Places, which came out, I believe, in 1989. And then was turned into a movie by Oliver Stone. But then there came Duke's book in 1994, very shortly after that. And it was a very different kind of book, because I think the books that came before Duke's, including Lily Hayslip's, oftentimes translated or co-written in English, the number of, I'm trying to remember how many actually might have been written by the author himself or herself. I think there was only a couple that come to mind. So his Where the Ashes Are was a really remarkable book, one of the very few single-authored in English books by a Vietnamese American, and someone from a very interesting background. Duc, as the son of the governor of Hue, and someone who left Vietnam at sort of an impressionable age in his teens, and went on to become had to make his own life as a activist, as someone who was helping Vietnamese refugees, and then as someone who became a journalist and who was thinking about these questions of exile, the refugee experience, war, colonialism, the diaspora. All of that is there in Where the Ashes Are, wrapped up with his family memoir and the sense of loss, obviously, that he had been separated from his family for a long time, including his father and his sister. So I think many of the patterns of Vietnamese American literature before and afterwards, especially afterwards, are present in this book. So it was really a groundbreaking, I think, kind of work in Where the Ashes Are.
I will add to what Viet said. He wrote, about history, but also the story of his father who went to re-education camps, right? And then the way is very unlike other memoir, right? Because often it's about one person in his years, like the story of two people and his time in refugee camp and so forth. And the really strong strands of nostalgia, where the home is, where the ashes are. And it's like in Vietnam, right? You want to return to Vietnam, a strong attachment to Vietnam. And some people have said that the reason he was not, because he went out of print and he was not republished is because it's not like one single narrative about himself. It's himself, and the second part is focused on his father. And I thought that interesting, right? And I wish, but it's very Vietnamese in a way.
Yeah, that is an interesting. Well, that is it's interesting too, because that has been an aspect of the memoir I've enjoyed quite a lot, is the dual narratives. But it's interesting that you point out that maybe makes it more difficult to, I don't know, would you say market or
Yeah,
you know.
he went out of print and he was not published, right? So it's harder to teach, right? It doesn't fit in some of the model of memoirs, but it's an important book, and I wish it was reprinted.
I think it was reprinted by the University of Nebraska Press. So yeah, so that came out, I think, in 2016, if I'm looking at the date correctly.
Okay, because I was looking for it at some point and it was not there, so I was like, give up. Okay, great. It's good to know. Thank you.
Isabel, you mentioned just now, which I'm curious to hear more about, the you said that's that sort of aspect of storytelling, the dual narrative is very Vietnamese. What do you mean by that?
Oh, if it's not, it's very Vietnamese, but all I say is, that there's sometimes the we, the collective identity, right? The clan, right? It's not so like individualistic, maybe as a culture. And here it's very individualistic, and the memoir is really much about the self and how the self impacted by the outside world. But here it's focusing on him and also on his father, right? In this is what happened to his father is as important to what happened to him. He wanted to honor that and speak to that, I believe. And maybe
Well
he
said.
has a weight of representation, of representing what happened to that generation who sometimes, couldn't write in English or would not be published in English, right? To give voice. So some have argued that he has a bit of the weight of representing that generations. But from knowing him, I think he really wanted his father's story to be heard and told and known.
And that makes sense too, because to understand like that, like you said, a lot of memoirs are about one, individual, but it's important that, like, to understand the other individuals around you and their stories and how, that impacts you as well. We've mentioned like his, the memoir, and we've also talked about his journalism and radio. Do you, in knowing him, did you ever learn of, or do you think he perhaps approached a different form with different mindsets? Or you say he's writing a journalistic piece. Do you think he's kind of thinking about that differently than, say, the memoir or a radio segment? Just curious if you have any insights into his process.
I think that's an interesting question. Obviously, as a journalist, he would have a different approach in some ways. I mean, his memoir is obviously very, very personal and about his family. But in his journalism, I always got the sense that he had to at least have a. I mean, his journalism was oftentimes autobiographical in the sense that he was interested in certain questions because of his refugee background and his cosmopolitan background as someone who had fled Vietnam but had also chosen to remake himself as a bohemian. But when he was doing his journalism coverage, he obviously also had to have some objectivity in there, that the pieces weren't only about him. So I think there was a sense of difference between his professional world as a journalist versus his memoiristic world. But his curiosity in terms of human beings certainly helped him with the journalistic work. And one thing I'll point out here that's personally important to me is that he gave me my first break in terms of doing radio. So he had a show called Pacific Time, and he had me write and record little personal pieces for that. So that was my first, and that was very young. I think I was in my, mid to late 20s. I think that was some of my earliest experiences writing for an audience outside of academia, because I was a graduate student and then a young professor. And I credit that experience with beginning to teach me how to speak, on the radio, which I don't know if that even exists anymore very much, but it's taught me a lot about how to, perform in general. That was sort of the beginnings of my own work in terms of being conscious of an audience came about through his, again, this model of generosity, but also of mentoring as well. So I think that was part of his work as a journalist, not only writing reports and doing the investigations and talking to people, but also cultivating other people as well, cultivating contacts for the network, but also cultivating younger voices.
Yeah, and he also wrote poetry and these translations, Vietnamese to English, of work he liked. And in terms of, I mean, we met him like so many years ago, right? 1994, right? But, one thing that he really pushed us to do, to think about, extending support to, Vietnamese American writers, but also to writers in other countries, but also in Vietnam, because he made the arguments that some young people in Vietnam are also in between. They went to an international school. They're not, a little bit different than people in Vietnam. They're a little bit different, than American, and say, oh, there's more similarity than difference between some younger Vietnamese writers in Vietnam than writers in the U.S. And we could not do this right away, but we heard him. And when we can, we do include Vietnamese writers to translate them into English and to follow his lead. But we had to do it, depending on funding and also, just as when we can. But he's been there, he's been following what we've been doing, and gently give us his ideas and what he thought we did well and what he thought we could do better.
Yeah, that sounds like a great mentor. Yeah. And I'm curious if you, and maybe perhaps this is an odd way to describe writing, but we talked about generosity a lot. And would you perhaps call his writing generous? He's spending his time with people, making connections, human to human, but there's something to perhaps about what he's left behind to us, perhaps a sort of generosity in the words he's left on the page to us.
We talked a little bit earlier about how Where the Ashes Are is not quite your typical memoir because it includes the perspectives and experiences of his father. And I think that's one example of this. Oftentimes people are tempted to write memoirs, it's all about them. And I think he was resisting that idea That was an interesting model for other Vietnamese American writers. Like unfortunately, the writer Andrew X. Pham, who just passed away a couple of a week or two ago, also wrote a memoir called The Eves of Heaven, in which he included his father's experiences as well. And Andrew is just a little bit younger than Duc was. So I think that idea that you could write a memoir, but it would not just purely be about you, marks what Duc was doing, but also marks a lot of what we have tried to do with the Diasporic Vietnamese Artist Network, which is to foreground writers, but not their egos, to try to foreground writers who are also interested in the spirit of community, collaboration, dialogue, and so on. And there was no doubt that we absorbed some of that from Duc's own spirit also.
Thank you for that. And now I'm also curious if you have taught Duc in your classes or to students, and if so, how do you introduce him, and what is the student's reception if they've heard of him before, or if it's the first time reading him? I'm curious how you teach Nguyen Quy Duc.
Well, when the reason I thought it was out of print because I actually wanted to teach that book and I was looking for it and it was out of print then, so I thought Southwind Changing instead. It was also published in 1994 and it's more like memoir narrative, right? Also re-education camp, right? From a young man that students could relate to, but I've written about it and they read what I wrote about him. So quoting him, especially at the end when he talks about the notion of home, and said something about I remember talking about the pleasure he found. He appears to found in his writing about exploring the pain and staying with the pain. And I know we use the word romantic a little bit earlier on. And I remember, in the French romantic and 19th century, right? This idea that you get up like scratching your scab, right? Because you wanted to keep the wound open. And I wrote about that a little bit and to stay with that. I don't know if I would say think this way, but there was something, I don't know, bohemian romantic aspect of him and how he used language and poetry and his way of being was as that. So I read excerpt from the book, but I never taught the book because I really thought it was, a few times I looked, it was out of print. So now I'm glad it is in print now. So I don't know. I'm going back to teach in the fall, so I don't know.
We mentioned it before, and what you just said reminded me again, Isabel. But like, I'm curious to learn more about the persona that he crafted that you talked about, and more so, and more specifically, if and how that perhaps impacted his writing, or were they kind of was everything crafted kind of, do you think, simultaneously, like persona and writing, or did any sort of his outward persona impact his writing at all?
Well, it's hard to tell, but he was just one of a kind, the way he dressed. He designed, he was a, he has a very keen attention to, aesthetic. His bow, if you look at it, is really his style. This is his house, in the mountain. Is the way, his mixture of, I don't know, it's Duc style, but there's a little bit of, Asians theme and maybe some European theme, rustic bohemians, but very beautifully aesthetically, very beautiful. And then he also with clothing, he has, I think he was actually he designed clothes and he sold clothes and object and sculpture. So he was, I think he was just a real artist, in that sense that everything he touched had this aesthetic. He pay attention to aesthetic. And on his body too, right? The way he dressed, the way his glasses were, the way he shaved, the way his hair, he was part of him, right? It's just the artist and persona and the generosity, and he always had food and alcohol around and smoke. That's kind of, and then when guests came, he took them around. It took the time to show them around and make people special. But I think he ended up costing him of some of his health too, right? As he had some, it was sometime at his expense because when he was ill, he was still doing that and for a long time. And I don't know how he did it actually with, I couldn't have this lifetime while staying up late like this and And it had to be really physically strong to do this. So I think it's more about his way of being, and all of that came across in whatever he touched, whatever is aesthetic, the outside world, but also, his writing. And he had a very keen ear for poetry, and really wanted to support others in that spirit. That's what I'm saying.
I knew that he was working for a long time on a novel, and I never saw any pages of it. And I don't know what became of it. I'd be really interested in that. I mean, part of his fast, I think, had the novel had something to do with Morocco, because he was fascinated by Morocco. That part I knew for sure. That he spent a lot of time there, that he found some type of second home or third home, as the case might be, in Morocco, partly because of the shared history of French colonization there, but I think just also a fascination with the culture there. And he had told me a long time ago that he was working on this book set in Morocco, which would fit this entire, trajectory we've been talking about in terms of exile, colonialism, self-fashioning, the role of the writer in terms of imagining and forging their own life for themselves, and the idea of the cosmopolitan. Which in Dook's case, I think, was always rooted not just in the cosmopolitanism of the expat, but the cosmopolitanism of the person who's forced into exile as a refugee. And that history of Morocco and Vietnam, I think, is still something that needs to be written. We're starting to see some glimpses of that, because there has been an overlapping history between Morocco and Vietnam in terms of, the Moroccan soldiers who went to Vietnam to fight with the French colonial army, but then also the other trajectories of the Moroccan and Vietnamese mixing that Duc represented.
Yeah, and then what I might add to this is that he's talking about his this novel that Viet was talking about. From what I remember, it was from the perspective of a white man going natives, and he was very frustrated because he couldn't find a publisher to publish that because it was not, it was from a perspective of a white man, right? And then not about the war, not about the Vietnam War, not about his identity as a refugees. And he was very frustrated that, although he knew his writing was good, if he didn't write about that, his personal experience, it would not be published. And I think a lot of my work up to these days have been influenced by something he thought was very problematic. And I kept hearing from other writers through the years. Things have changed. Now I think he has some writing, translations, and also essays, collection of essays. I was talking, actually, we were thinking, we were just talking with his partner, actually, maybe to potentially publish it, right, through our imprints. I mean, we still, I mean, when she's ready, but he has a manuscript that he's nobody's seen. Yeah.
Who has the manuscript, Isabel?
Fung is in his computer.
That's his partner.
Yeah, this been, yeah, we've been talking about it.
Well, that is exciting. I'm curious if you know of any of Duke's favorite writers. Did he have any writers that he especially liked to read, or any favorite novels or books or anything that came up a lot in your conversations?
You know the name of that famous Vietnamese singer in Vietnam?
Trịnh Công Sơn.
Yes, he translated that singer. And then I think he translated Phan Công Chiang, who is a philosopher from Vietnam who studied in Paris and very dark and nostalgic and tormented, right? Really, he translated some of that, thinking you like that. I don't know yet if you know more.
Trịnh Công Sơn is super famous among the Vietnamese, and unfortunately, the term used to describe him, and I really hate this term because it asks for an equivalence, is the Vietnamese Bob Dylan. And I guess it gives you a sense of who Trịnh Công Sơn was during the 60s and 70s, but again, I just dislike that kind of a comparison. But Trịnh Công Sơn is a songwriter whose body of songs was suppressed by both the communists and the anti-communists, because these were anti-war, pro and pro-peace songs. So he wasn't necessarily very ideological, but those songs really marked an entire generation of South Vietnamese people, including the refugees and the exiles, among whom Duc would be would be counted. And the most famous renditions of Jin Gong Sun songs were sung by the singer Han Li, who was also the most famous of the Vietnamese singers of that generation. And it was, in my mind, always associated with smoke and alcohol and nostalgia and longing and loss, all these themes that we've been discussing. So yeah, I think that if there was a musical equivalent to Duk, it would probably be like Jin Gong Sun. And so it would make sense that he was influenced by that model.
Did he also play music himself? Any instruments or anything like that?
I don't think
Think
No. Yeah.
so.
Just an appreciator of the art.
Yes.
Yeah, like
He would invite all kinds of different musicians to
yeah.
Dadioto and Hanoi.
That's great. And have either of you been to the Daddy Oto?
Yes.
Yeah.
They went through different variations, so I don't know which variation I went into, but I think I probably went into one of the earliest ones. I think it was at two or three different locations. But yeah, I mean, it was not a place, as far as I know, that was featured in like the backpacker guides, for example. So if you
Right.
go to
Okay.
Vietnam, and maybe I haven't been to Vietnam since 2014, and I haven't traveled with one of these backpacker guides in a long time. So I don't know how accurate these comments are, but back in the 2000s, if you went to Vietnam, you knew exactly where to go if you were of a Western backpacking or low budget kind of a background, Backpacker's Alley in Saigon or the equivalent in Hanoi. And that was not the kind of bar that Dadioto was. Dadioto was more for the cognoscenti, I guess, the people who were connected in some way through these circuits of the expat world, NGOs, artists, the diplomatic circle, the multilingual group of people who would not be caught dead in a backpacker's hotel, not because of the money issue, but simply because like the backpackers are stereotypically being drawn to these places where it was all about billiards and cheap beer and all that kind of thing. And Duke's bar was much more elegant, I think. And that's what I remember about it. Dark, elegant, with a host who was always ready to have a drink with you.
It sounds like a great place, honestly. It sounds like a great spot to spend an afternoon and catch up. I like the idea of it too, of the notion of a space, like a physical space too. And because that's kind of been I've been thinking about that our whole conversation. You mentioned that like building that community of ink and blood at first, and then but just like that's it is a physical space too. But then this Tadioto is like also of physical space, but then also has more of a spiritual meaning almost, or sort of significance in that sense. So I'm just curious if you have any thoughts on what Duke has taught you about place and spaces and creating ones for yourselves.
I remember the last time I visited Dadioto, and I have a poor memory, about time, but it was a night where he had performances there, and he himself performed that night. So there was a slideshow of images while he read his poetic prose there, with the images. It wasn't only him; there were other artists as well. But there are some writers whose work we turn to with their books. And then we forget who they are as individuals, right? Whereas with Duke, I think it's almost the opposite. Like he's left a memory of who he was as a person, as a performer, as an organizer, as a person who created spaces for people. And I think there's great value to that as well. So in that sense, your question about sort of a kind of a spirituality, I don't think he was religious as far as I can remember. But I think he, art was his muse, and his persona was lived through that muse, and I think that's what the strongest memories about Duc are.
Yeah, and then the business is very much attached to his charisma, his persona, as Viet says, because now, the business continue, but it's just not the same, and he was going to do something else, but it'll be very difficult for people to continue what they did without him, because people was drawn to the space he created, but also to him as a person.
Yeah, well said. Thank you for that. As we're getting close to the end here, but before we wrap up, was there anything that either of you wanted to mention that we haven't discussed yet about Duke or your own connections with him?
I just think of the title of his book, Where the Ashes Are, and then sometimes I'm sad like to hear about what happened to his ashes, right? And his family brought to his ashes to Wei, where his family is, and And maybe his partner say, oh, but he wanted his ashes to go to Dalat because he was the most happiest there. And we still, to this day, we will not know exactly what he wanted, but the family decided. But something about, I don't know, it just remind me of that recital of his book, and how that was related to home, the notion of home. And he will spend a lot of his time and life to define home in his own term. And it happened to be in Vietnam, and he was, he really went to Vietnam because it was cheaper to take care of his mother, but he did it here as well, with us. And I believe he did some of that the same ways in England, when he was there. So where he was, he created homes.
I remember that in the early to mid 90s, we at Ink and Blood staged a play called Tony D. And Tony D was based on a short story by the Vietnamese writer Lê Minh Huê, who was actually a North Vietnamese war veteran and was therefore, also a Communist Party cadre and became one of the better known Vietnamese writers of the war generation and the immediate post-war generation. And the t story of Tony D is about the bones of an American GI and these efforts by this Vietnamese people to, get those bones and to turn them over to Americans. So it was actually a short story and a play about reconciliation. And when we staged that play at SF at San Francisco State, it was a big deal because hundreds of people from the Vietnamese American community in the Bay Area came out to protest us. And it was ironic because they were protesting the play because Lê Minh Huê was a war, North Vietnamese war veteran, therefore the enemy, even though Lê Minh Huê's story is about reconciliation. And I think that, that exemplified Duc's spirit. Like in the early to mid 90s, doing anything that was about reconciliation was tantamount to embracing communism for the Vietnamese American community. And yet he did it. He was the one who I think instigated the whole thing. And it was an interest, it was a good lesson for me because number one, none of us were playwrights, none of us were directors or actors, and yet we decided to put on a play. How did that happen? That we had to assemble all of these elements to make the play happen. And then we had to have the courage to put on the play despite these kinds of protests that were taking place. And I remember, San Francisco State University brought out its police department to protect us and to make sure that the play went on. So that was a good lesson for me early on about number one, the importance of art when it comes to reconciliation, but also the necessity for artists to stand up for what they believe in, even against their own community. If the Vietnamese American community is our community, we still had to put on this play, even if we were going to be protested by them. All of these lessons, I think, are still really, really important for me, have helped to shape me in terms of my willingness to stand up and be protested against for various reasons. But I remember that moment as being a very exciting one, challenging one, in both artistic and political ways, but also an evanescent moment. We've talked earlier about permanence and archives and legacies and things like this. And there is no, as far as I can tell, archive or legacy about this performance, except in my memory and the memory of whoever was there. And yet, I think that's still important. The idea, we haven't really talked about Duc too much as someone who put on performances, but performances are different than literary books and texts. Literary books and texts are there in print, that can be recovered from an archive if they're out of print. But performances are not necessarily meant to last, which would also be a commentary about the performance of one's own life as well.
I don't know how to follow that one up. Yeah, that's I love that a lot. And I love the fact that, like you said, there's no archive or record of it, but it is in your body, like your memory has it for sure and impacted, your own work since then. So it's good to point out the connections along the way that have, brought us through the community to where we are now. Well, Isabel, Viet, thank you so much for joining me today. I had a blast chatting with you, and you both have books coming out or just came out, right? Could you tell us a little bit about your stuff that just came out?
Thanks, Nate. It was great talking to you about our dear friend, Nguyễn Quy Đức. It's always a pleasure to be here with Isabel, my collaborator. on a book that just came out called The Cleaving: Vietnamese Writers of the Diaspora. It's a collection of 37 Vietnamese diasporic writers conversing with each other. We think of it as rather a landmark book. There are not too many books like this about any particular national group of writers in exile. And it really demonstrates this vast range of Vietnamese diasporic writing with people coming from the United States, Canada, France, Australia, and even Israel, where Vietnamese refugees ended up as well. And I also just published a book called To Save and to Destroy, Writing as an Other, which are a set of essays on that topic, and really reached back to my own experiences as an undergraduate, where I started to think about what otherness meant, including with Ink and Blood, this predecessor to the Diasporic Vietnamese Artist Network. And Isabel also has another collection that she can tell us about, The Make-Believers.
Believers, yes, but I was not editor. I was editor of this book, so that was
The
you know
cleaving, the cleaving.
a lot of the cleaving that we gathered those dialogues at our residencies and public event, or when the with COVID the public events were we had to close. We couldn't have them. We have them on Zoom, and then we frame them. And it's published by UC Press, and I'm very proud of this book. The Make Believers is was we were invited by McSweeney, which is very established, literary magazine, to create all the writers and staff were also writers from our residency to create, to contribute, and to make this special issue for the commemorate the 50 years of the end of the Vietnam War. And I love it because, well, it's designed by Thi Bui and by other Vietnamese American artists inside of different booklets. And we really it was with the spirit. You see everybody smoking and drinking and eating, right? Of Nguyen Quy Duc, he was supposed to be there. But also everybody felt, free to write. I would say it, Nguyen Quy Duc was very frustrated that he couldn't really speak on his own terms, because he have equally wanted to write, to publish a book about this white man going native in Morocco, and couldn't publish that book because of, he's a good writer, right? So it has to do with expectation of the publishers. But here we really emphasize through those residencies about speak your truth, just give each other strength and courage to do this and collaborate with each other. So there's dialogues, there's very quirky short stories, there's like the definitions of Vietnamese language, how Vietnamese American or French Vietnamese or other Vietnamese in diaspora use it and recreate a kind of a dictionary, and is humorous, funny, quirky, and also sometimes very deep and very sad, right? Which is encompass, more the whole, humanity of those writers, instead of more slivers that is usually, invited to be presented in mainstream culture. So that's great. Yeah, it's beautiful text,
Two
essay.
things that Isabel did not mention: the residency in question was in the south of France, so it was really, a cool re I wasn't invited, so it was a really cool
Yes,
residency for everything I saw on social media.
you were supposed to
Oh,
be there. You
no,
were
I
supposed to be
wasn't.
there. No, you
I
were
was
supposed to be there,
flying.
and you could not be there.
My memory is faulty,
Yes,
but
no.
so I was not there. But there's a bunch of other great writers there, from France and the United States and Vietnam, I believe. But the other thing about the Make Believers, which is officially McSweeney's 78, is that it's a one of a kind collector edition. I don't think there are that many copies of this. It's not a book, it's actually a boxed set. And inside the box are all kinds of goodies, which I can't really describe because I've been so busy. I haven't even opened my box set yet of the Make Believers. And we can't show it to you because this is a audio podcast. But trust me, go to McSweeney's.net. It's number 78. And it is really kind of a, McSweeney's always does something unique with each of its special issues. And I've never seen anything like this.
Yeah.
And then, if I may say, with this other thing that came out for the 15th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War, that we created, produce a big event in San Francisco, is the Best of Diacritics. And this is diacritic is started with a blog started by Viet, like what, 15 years ago, and we collected the best of those essays, and now it's going to become a print magazine in December. So this is the launch of this with the new website. So by and then in the spirit of Duke, right? Since we're going to this is the theme of this podcast is what we try to do with Divan, right? Just to have established writers to present with emerging writers, right? To bring attention, to bring support, right? So we'll do this through a print magazine who would be, with established writers, written by established writers and artists, or maybe, organic intellectuals. But also on our website, we'll continue to have essay by emerging artists and writers to continue with this legacy of mutual support and to move away from this idea of tokenism, only one writer can represent the whole community that Duke sometimes felt pressure to take on, and some have argued, it can I think Monique Strong, right, that it can really stifle one's creativity when you have to be the first one to represent. You have only one chance to speak for the community, represent the community. So this is really moving away from that. So more people with these talents can be free to really be free. Just maybe 50 years after the war, maybe that's the time to do this like openly.
You can see more about Diacritics and make the Make Believers on DVAN.org, which is our website that has all these resources about all the many things we've been discussing that DVAN does, from publishing Diacritics to our residencies to our talk show and podcast, Accented Dialogues of the Diaspora, hosted by me, and many other things. All of these things are done in the spirit of Duke. They are done with almost no resources and no money initially, and then we grow them into something larger for the entire community.
Yes, thank you for that. Yeah, and there are links in the episode description for you listeners to check out everything, these books and issues and all that as well. Yeah, Isabel, thank you again.
Thanks so much, Nate.
Thank you so much for having us. It's really a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you'd like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., only closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.